Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. Mexico is a major source of illegal drugs coming into the United States. The drug trade has been very lucrative for organized gangs in Mexico, and all of that money has made it possible for these gangs to purchase the cooperation of elements in the Mexican government and the police. And some people have actually said things are getting so bad in Mexico that it is on its way to becoming a narco state. We'll be talking this morning about the growing influence of the Mexican drug cartels, perhaps on both sides of the border. And our guest for the program is a former agent of the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Administration. His name is Michael Braun. He has had a long career in law enforcement, going back to the mid-1970s when he was a police officer in Cape Girardeau, Missouri. After that, he joined the ranks of the Illinois State Police and worked largely in narcotics enforcement. And then in 1985, he went to work for the DEA. At the time of his retirement, he served as chief of operations. He was responsible for leading the worldwide drug enforcement operations of the agency's 227 domestic and 86 foreign offices, as well as the Special Operations Division, the Aviation Division, and the Office of Diversion Control. And he has had a number of posts during the time that he worked in the DEA, including working in Houston and also in Los Angeles. He's talking with us this morning by telephone, and as we talk, questions and comments from listeners are certainly welcome. All you have to do is pick up the telephone and dial the number, and that is 333-9455. That's the number for Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good for you, if that would be a long-distance call, if you're listening around Illinois and Indiana and you're listening over the air, or you might happen to be listening over the internet across the country, either way, you can use the toll-free line, and that is 800-222-9455. So again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. At any point here, if you have questions and comments, you're certainly welcome to call. We just ask people to be brief, just so that we can keep things moving along, get in as many callers as possible, but certainly your calls are welcome. Mr. Braun, hello.
Good morning, David. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
Fine, thank you.
Good. Well, we appreciate you giving us some of your time. To start out with, I guess I would expect that for some time now, Mexico has been important, has played a role in the movement of illegal drugs into the United States, if for no other reason than it's been a transshipment point. Drugs have come in from outside of Mexico, and then they've come from Mexico here. But apparently, now we're getting into a very different situation with Mexico, and as I read, it has, for some categories of illegal drugs, has become the most important source of those drugs coming in the United States, or perhaps number two. Can you talk just a little bit about the role now that the country of Mexico plays in the movement of illegal drugs into the United States?
Sure. I mean, let me try to explain really the dynamics at work here and the dynamics that have been at work for a long, long time. Mexico is a production country for heroin, marijuana, and methamphetamine. To a lesser degree, some designer drugs. They are not a production country for cocaine. Cocaine is produced, for the most part, only in three countries in the Western Hemisphere, or really three countries in the world, and all three of those countries are in the Andean region: Colombia, Peru, and Bolivia. Again, for many years, Mexico has been involved, and our powerful cartels have been involved in the production of marijuana, heroin, and methamphetamine. They had the longstanding infrastructure, logistics infrastructure in place to move those drugs and other contraband across our border into the United States. When we cracked down on the Caribbean corridor, that principal route in the beginning really in the early 70s through probably almost the mid 1980s, that principal route for cocaine and South American heroin and marijuana grown in Colombia, when we cracked down on that Caribbean corridor, in the mid-1980s and were very effective in shutting that down. The Colombian cartels at that point developed very close relations and formed alliances with the Mexican cartels to start moving cocaine through Mexico from Central America and ultimately from the Andean region through Central America, through Mexico and across the border with the United States. When that all started, during that period, the Colombians began paying the Mexican cartels in cash simply for moving the drugs across the border. What it evolved into over the years was an arrangement where the Colombians paid them in kind, meaning they were paid with parts of each load of cocaine that they were moving. If you look at what's happening today, it started out with, like I believe, as I can recall, 10% of each load was the Mexican cartel's take. Today, it's roughly half of each load that they move across the border. And what that's provided the Mexican cartels basically is another market that they controlled not only in their country and other countries around the globe, including the United States. It provided them with control of at least half of the cocaine distribution market.
So I would expect that would mean then for the Mexican cartels, the amounts of money that they could make from the drug trade, not just from helping to move drugs, that is from being the middleman, so to speak, to the point where they actually have product that belongs to them, which they can also sell. And does that mean that the kind of revenues that they can realize have increased?
Yeah, undoubtedly. And you've got to understand something that, you know, this is not a 100 or multi-hundred million dollar enterprise. It's a billion-dollar enterprise. The best estimates by the United Nations for the flow of drugs between Mexico, the United States, and Canada is about $147 billion a year in revenue generated. Now, obviously, some of that money goes back to Colombia, but a great deal of it goes right back into Mexico. There is not a week that goes by when DEA, working with local and state law enforcement counterparts across the country and with other federal partners and with our Mexican counterparts south of the border, and that's a very important point to make, there is seldom a week that goes by when we're not seizing one or more multi-million dollar cash shipments of money that these groups are attempting to repatriate across the border and back to the cartels in Mexico.
The it seems that one of the big problems here in dealing with this is that on the side of Mexico, that the cartels, they have so much money that they're able to buy police officers and other people who work in law enforcement in Mexico, and there even and perhaps people have read some of these stories that they have actually managed to buy the influence and the cooperation of people within the Mexican government.
Well, I mean, it's very important to understand that these cartels operate just like Fortune 500 companies, and that's a very important point to make right up front. And hopefully, we've got time to get into my explaining or describing to you and your audience just how sophisticated their organizational structures are. Mm-hmm. But suffice it to say that they invest hundreds of millions of dollars a year to corrupt. Not long ago, DEA, who as an agency has relied has historically relied heavily on the development of human intelligence coming from sources, if you will, around the globe. we conducted a survey of some of our top operatives globally and basically attempting to get a better handle on exactly how global drug trafficking cartels operate Where are their vulnerabilities? Where are their weaknesses? Every one of those top operatives replied the same way. The number one, we see it as a vulnerability, but the number one thing that they have to do to survive is corrupt. If they cannot penetrate government, if they, including, you know, your typical security entities, law enforcement, the entire judicial system, militaries, and intelligence services, then they cannot operate. They have got to corrupt to keep their enterprise afloat and moving forward.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you have the kind of money that they do, and then if for their survival, in addition, it's that important, it seems to me that from our side would be very, very difficult. I have no idea what your average Mexican police officer makes, but I'm sure that it's not very much, and that there would be great opportunities here to tempt people by offering them significant amounts of money that they otherwise, legally doing their jobs, couldn't earn. What do you do about something like that?
Well, I've got to tell you that President Calderon and his administration, his Attorney General Eduardo Medina Mora, a very noble man, the head of the of their federal security police, Genaro Garcia Luna, a very noble guy. They're working hard within the administration and within the Mexican Congress to tackle the corruption issue. They want to vet all law enforcement personnel in the country at the federal level and then start that same process at the state and local levels. And what do I mean by vetting? Polygraphs, urinalysis, very strict background investigations, and sustain that effort or have those things recurring on a regular basis to keep their personnel and to keep their ranks honest. They're working very closely with their Congress on pay reform legislation, because pay and benefit reform, I mean, you touched on a very important topic here. I think your average local police officer in Mexico is paid under $500 a month. Now look, you know, if that cop is married and that officer has, you know, even one child, you've got 3 mouths to feed, you've got typically a mortgage payment, you've got the car payment, you know, life's, you know, the things that all of us have to deal with in life. And it doesn't take an economist to understand that. You know, there's got to be money coming in from someplace else to keep that family alive and well.
Mm. Let me reintroduce our guest for this part of Focus 580. We're talking with Michael Braun. He is retired from the DEA. He, at the point where he retired, was serving as the chief of operations. He was responsible for their worldwide drug enforcement, and that included operations of more than 220 domestic and more than 80 foreign offices, also special operations, aviation, the Office of Diversion Control. He has had a long career in the DEA and in law enforcement. Right now, he is managing partner with Spectre Group International. That's a private firm that works in the area of law enforcement and intelligence work. Questions are certainly welcome here. We're talking about the drug trade between Mexico and the United States and what has been happening with Mexico in recent years, how that has become now a much more important source of illegal drugs coming into the United States. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. Oh, we do have a caller here. Someone wants to join in the conversation in the community of Belgium, not that far away. This is line number 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Hello. Good morning to you both. Sir, this discussion has been going on now for, 75 years. As soon as they signed the act to criminalize various drugs, we've had problems with this. We found it out in Prohibition, we had problems with this. The true problem with the whole system you want to solve the problem is take the profitability out of drugs, and pretty soon the people who are involved in drugs won't be. The way we take it out of profitability is change our paradigm when it comes to drugs. It's the only way we're going to solve this problem.
Well, Mr. Braun, that's the argument that a lot of people would make.
Well, look, first of all, I appreciate the caller's the caller calling in, and I appreciate the question, and I respect it. This is exactly the kind of dialogue that we've got to get back on the plate throughout the United States. But let me just make a few comments. Most people in our country believe that our current situation with respect to drug abuse and addiction in our country is a result of the counterculture, you know, in the early to mid 1960s, and that we've made no progress to date. What people have to understand, and what the caller's issue, what it really boils down to, is: shouldn't we just legalize drugs and all of these problems would go away if we decriminalize these things? Understand that this, you know, the situation we're in right now is nothing new to our country. The worst period of drug addiction and abuse in our nation's history was the 30 to 40 year period after our Civil War, when one in every 200 Americans was addicted to either an opioid, opium, morphine principally, heroin later, or they were addicted to a coca-based product, cocaine. Why? Because you could walk in any drugstore in the United States and buy those products off the shelf. They were not regulated. There was no criminal. There was no criminal legislation attached whatsoever to that activity. So all that the caller needs to do, or anyone else in our country needs to do, is go back in time and look at history. Anywhere in the world where drugs have been decriminalized or were never criminalized, they are eventually recriminalized because legalization simply does not work. The caller also said that prohibition didn't work. Au contraire, there is enormous amounts of data that showed clearly that during the prohibition days, the level of treatment for alcoholism in our country plummeted. The numbers of incidents of sclerosis of the liver, which is indicative of alcoholism or are related to alcoholism, plummeted. All right? So there are plenty of facts out there that prove the caller wrong. This is a very complex issue. The other thing that I would say, David, is that, okay, let's decriminalize all this and let's just, you know, let's just see what happens. Okay, well, are we going to decriminalize methamphetamine? Are we going to decriminalize heroin? Are we going to decriminalize LSD? Do the callers want their kids on the school bus tomorrow morning that's driven by someone that did LSD the night before or methamphetamine the night before or maybe when they got up in the morning? This is a complex issue, and there are no easy answers. The final thing that I would tell you is what the media most often, we hear from the media most often, is that we've lost the drug war. And we not only from the media, but from many. But we've lost the drug war. First of all, that was a terrible metaphor to begin with, all right, this notion of a drug war. But there's plenty of information that shows clearly also that there are somewhere between 40 to 50% fewer people in our country today abusing illicit drugs than there were in 1979 at the height of the problem during this most recent era of drug abuse and drug addiction in our country. So, you know, if what I often say is if some medical research team had reduced or was able to reduce diabetes, as an example, by 40% or 50% since 1979, somebody would be getting a Nobel Prize.
Sir, I'd like to point out that I'm saying change the paradigm, change looking the way we look at it in many ways. That doesn't mean we have to decriminalize it, sir. We can put those drugs, just like every other drugs, in the hands of pharmacists and deal with the problem in a more... more sensible way. It's because the way we're doing it now, sir, we are developing problems in Mexico, in Afghanistan, wherever we might want to look. Our rules and laws are promoting problems elsewhere. We've got to change this.
Okay. Well, I appreciate you calling in. I really do. And this is exactly the kind of dialogue that we've got to get out on the front plate again, because it's especially in this post 9/11 era that we're living in, it just hasn't been an important topic for most folks. It needs to be an important topic again. So thanks for your call. I appreciate it.
Yeah, I appreciate the comments of the caller as well. Other people who have questions, comments, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. And I think that perhaps, when we get into this kind of discussion and people talk about what it is that we have done, has it worked, has it not worked, how might we change things, and we have people talk about either legalization or decriminalization of things that now are legal, people seem to be making the argument that if we did that, then there would be no more black market, essentially, in these substances. And I wonder, in fact, whether you think that's true, or even if they were legally available, there still would be an underground, under the counter kind of trade in these things.
Well, I mean, exactly. Look, if they're decriminalized, then there's only one answer. Government's got to step in and regulate their availability, their distribution, how they're manufactured, to ensure that the users are receiving exactly what they think they're receiving, which again is another important dynamic to this, another important dimension to this, debate, because when the government steps in and takes on something like that, just as it has had to do with cigarettes and alcohol, the taxpayer pays for all of those services, as well as the resulting activity when the addiction rates and the abuse and addiction rates begin to literally go right through the ceiling. So there will always be a black market, and this is something that I'm speaking from a cop's perspective here, David. But this is the thing, after being out there for 33 years and working in some in the streets and tough areas around the United States as well as around the world, here's what concerns me most about this. Those who are responsible for distributing drugs in most communities around the globe don't focus their efforts primarily by age. Okay, so I mean, what do I mean by that? They don't focus their efforts on those below the age of 21 or those below the age of 18. If we were to legalize drugs, and I understand that the caller did not mean or was not suggesting, I do understand that now, and I appreciate that. But there are many others throughout our country and around the globe that believe we all just legalize this stuff and all of our problems are going to go away. Well, if you legalize these, very powerful drugs, far more powerful than alcohol, many of them, not all of them, many of them, but if you legalize them, you've got to attach some regulation there. So, throughout the United States, the age for being able to purchase and consume alcohol, for the most part, is 21 years old. Okay, are we going to attach that? If the government makes available LSD and heroin and cocaine and methamphetamine and high grade sensimilla marijuana with a THC content of, my God, 15%+, are we gonna come up with an age limit of 21? Then guess where the black market immediately shifts? Okay, every one of these predators will shift to those below the age of 21, and you want to know something? There are enough pressure on my kids right now. I don't need that, and I don't think any other American needs it either.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Michael Braun. He has had a long career in law enforcement, many years working with the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Administration. It's a branch of the Department of Justice that deals with illegal drugs. When he retired from the DEA, he was serving as chief of operations. He also had posts in the divisions in St. Louis, Houston, Los Angeles, Detroit. Before that, he worked in the Illinois State Police in narcotics enforcement and started out his career in law enforcement in the mid-70s as a police officer in Cape Girardeau, Missouri. Right now, he's managing partner with Spectre Group International. That's a private firm that works in the area of law enforcement and intelligence. And he's joining us this morning. We started out here talking about Mexico and its role in the drug trade and drugs coming into the United States. And perhaps it's natural that we would get into a more general kind of discussion about how what it is we do about the problem of illegal drugs. And that's okay, but that was not really the primary focus that we set out for the program. However, questions, comments certainly from people are welcome. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. We do have some other callers here, so let's go on. We'll talk with someone next in Mattoon on line one. Hello.
Hi. Quickly, Mayor Giuliani, when he was mayor, had a red zone where he said if you want to do drugs and whatever illegal stuff you want to do, you go into the red zone. You take 1 inch outside of it, and we'll beat you to a pulp. The cops enforced it, and those people who wanted to do that stayed in the red zone. Couldn't we have various red zones in various areas of the country where the people knew that if they wanted to come out of the red zone, they better be sober and not on drugs to whether they could drive and so forth? Then we wouldn't have to make it illegal, but at least that worked for Giuliani, and I'd like to know what this law enforcement individual thinks of that idea. Thank you.
Okay.
David, another great question. I'm not familiar with the initiative that the caller is talking about. I do know Mayor Giuliani. I know the guy personally, and this doesn't sound quite right to me. But let me just answer it this way. Folks that abuse very powerful drugs, including marijuana, because what most people don't realize in our country also is that today's marijuana is not your mommy or daddy's marijuana from the 1960s or 70s, okay? The THC content for marijuana that's abused throughout the country has just literally gone through the roof. There are more kids that are battling and struggling with marijuana, with their marijuana abuse and addiction. It is an addicting drug right now. The levels are right there along with alcohol for the first time ever. They're almost side by side from what I understand. But, I mean, let me say this, that when folks are abusing cocaine, LSD, heroin, PCP, methamphetamine, they don't make rash decisions. A few years ago, there was a movement it all fell under the umbrella of harm reduction. We can teach people how to use illicit drugs and maintain control of their faculties, etc. You can't. When you're under the influence of these very powerful mind-altering drugs, you're not. Does anyone believe for 1 minute that people like that are going to listen to a cop and stay confined in a red zone, whether that be a park or it be a vacant lot or a house or houses somewhere? No, they're not going to listen to anyone of authority. They're going to do whatever they do or want to do. Another big fallacy is that, you know, drug-related crime would go away if we legalized drugs and simply made them available, to people throughout all walks of life in our society, that all of our problems would go away. And again, it's absolutely a false assumption. People, most drug-related violence has nothing to do with people robbing a drugstore or robbing someone standing outside of an ATM or near an ATM. What it has to do with people making terrible decisions because they no longer control their faculties when they're under the influence of a very powerful mind-altering drug. And that's the reality of the situation.
Okay, let's talk again with another call. This is someone in Bloomington. This is our toll-free line, line four. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah.
I'd like to go back to what you talked about, kind of your focus on the war on drugs and its the name and the failure. But what it has done is created a large amount of fear for doctors that try to help people that are in chronic pain.
Well, I believe that fear is unfounded, and DEA is responsible for the compliance side of the house as well, and so the DEA is responsible for monitoring doctors and monitoring pharmacies and drug manufacturing and distribution facilities throughout the country. That's another role that the DEA plays. I can tell you that I believe it's 0.1% of the doctors in the United States are under investigation by the DEA for any wrongdoing. The vast majority of those, not only doctors, but those in the medical field, play by the rules, and they uphold their Hippocratic Oath. But there are times when some in the medical community succumb to corruption or other things that make them or cause them to choose to make the wrong decisions, and there can be enormous amounts of money made for writing prescriptions to folks who don't really need them. And I'll leave it at that. That's what ties up most of DEA's resources with respect to the compliance side of the house.
I understand that, but there are doctors that are in fear that haven't done anything wrong. I know that I had a frozen shoulder adhesive capsulitis where you can't move your arm, and if you move any motion causes extreme pain, which on the pain scale would be at the 10, 9 to 10, out of the 1 to from 0 to 10. And the doctor was hem and haw at the VA, hem and haw, and he knew I was in pain, but he said, if I write a prescription for pain medication, there is 150 people looking over my shoulder, and I could lose my job, my house, my everything that I've worked for. So it exists.
Well, I mean, I would... It's a great question, and once again, I'm really kind of blown away by the callers. This is good stuff, and I appreciate you calling in. What I would say is the doctor's ill-informed. He or she just absolutely is, and believe me, I'm sorry that happened to you. I've got lower back problems, and if you think that your doctor took notice with you when they look at my records and see that I was a chief of operations for DEA, if you think that they don't pay special attention to me you couldn't be more wrong. But I would simply say the doctor is ill-informed, and the doctor through the AMA and other associations, professional medical associations, can get the right scoop and I think relieve a lot of those worries.
Well, again, I want to thank the caller. We have about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Just very quickly, let me introduce again our guest, Michael Baran. He's a former chief of operations for the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Administration. Worked with the DEA for a long time and has had a long career in law enforcement. And we started out here talking about drugs and coming in from Mexico. And I want to get back to that, at least for a while here, because you said earlier you thought it would be interesting, you'd be interested in talking about how it is that the Mexican drug cartels are organized. You said they have very specialized organizational structures. And tell us about that.
Well, I think I touched earlier on this. These cartels, they run like Fortune 500 companies. They have highly sophisticated organizational structures. highly compartmentalized cells. They have cells that are responsible for nothing more than distribution, cells that are responsible for transportation, cells that are responsible for money laundering, individuals who are responsible for acquiring real estate throughout the United States where they can cachet money and drugs and you know, engage in their enterprise activities. It's important to say that also that that they all rely heavily on what I refer to as the hallmarks of organized crime. If they can't corrupt you, again, they've got hundreds of millions of dollars that they invest in corrupting on both sides of the border, by the way. If they can't corrupt you, then they'll turn to intimidation. And if intimidation doesn't work, they turn to extreme violence. In Mexico alone this year, there have been over 4,000 drug-related homicides. I think the most recent figures that I looked at my last week at DEA, which was less than a month ago, there had been 419 police officers, I believe, murdered and are killed as a result of drug violence in Mexico this past during that previous 10-month period. They rely on the latest in technology to shoot, move, and communicate. They rely on cell phones and satellite phones, oftentimes encrypted, by the way, encryption levels that are tough for law enforcement to deal with, DEA, FBI, and others at the federal level, and certainly for local and state law enforcement. But they also rely on the latest in technology to navigate. They rely heavily on GPS systems and other navigational aids. They have an uncanny ability to rejuvenate. When you hit them hard and you knock them off their feet, what you find is typically is 4 or 6 months later, what you're now looking at are going after doesn't look like, act like, smell like, you know, what you were dealing with, not long before that. They also thrive in permissive environments, weak nation states. And in fact, when you compare Mexican and Colombian drug cartels as examples, when you compare them to modern-day foreign terrorist organizations, they operate exactly the same. And in fact, most experts agree that your Colombian and Mexican drug trafficking cartels, the way that they have evolved over the last 30 years, they are far more complicated and complex threats than even some of your best Middle Eastern terrorist organizations. The only thing that really differentiates global drug cartels from foreign terrorist organizations is motivation. Drug traffickers have always been motivated by greed. It's all about money, and it's all about turf. It's all about power. Terrorist organizations are motivated by ideology. But then there's what I refer to, it's a term that I coined, we're now faced with hybrid organizations. So what do I mean by that? Hezbollah is an example, or the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, the FARC as an example, or the Taliban as an example. All are designated foreign terrorist organizations by our government. All three of those also, I believe, by the European Union and certainly many other countries around the globe, but they are now also involved heavily in the global drug trade. So with the hybrid, you have one part designated foreign terrorist organization, one part global drug trafficking organization. And this is just one guy's opinion, but I believe firmly that what we're looking at here is the face of 21st century global organized crime, and it's meaner and uglier than anything we've ever been faced with in federal law enforcement, our local or state law enforcement, and even our military services and our intel community.
Yeah. And just to underline the point you made, I think certainly for people in Mexico, increased levels of violence related to the drug trade. This is a very, very serious issue, not just because people in law enforcement have been targeted, journalists have been targeted, and also now, apparently, and increasingly people involved in the drug trade, drug cartels, have turned to kidnapping as a way of making money. And that's not, they're not kidnapping people who are involved in other drug organizations. They're just kidnapping people that they think have money,
right,
and holding them for ransom, and that the violence levels of violence have gone up very significantly. And another way that this involves the United States is apparently most of the guns that are used in Mexico to commit violence come from the United States.
Yeah, most of the guns, you know, most of the guns that are used by the cartels in Mexico do come from the United States. And I've got to tell you that, you know, the DEA is working very closely with our Mexican authorities, as well as our Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms and Explosives, the FBI and ICE and Customs and Border Protection, you know, to counter that flow out of the United States. I mean, we're partly responsible for sure, for a lot of this activity. But as hard as this may be to understand or to really, comprehend or wrap your arms around, I've got to say this because this is based on 33 years of experience in law enforcement. The violence in Mexico, I believe this firmly, is really a product of Mexico's success with respect to President Calderon drawing the line in the sand and basically saying we are going to take on the cartels, because if we don't, the government will no longer be running the country. The cartels will be running the country. Mm-hmm. All right? So I believe firmly that the violence is a product of their success, and I've got to draw a comparison to the country of Colombia here. If people will think back just 10 years ago, Colombia was experiencing much of the same levels of violence as Mexico is today. But thanks to Congress and Plan Colombia and an infusion of monies into Colombia to help President Uribe and his predecessor tackle, you know, the very powerful cartels in Colombia. Flash forward to today, in just 10 years, there's a law enforcement presence in that country in every community for the first time in that country's history. Their homicide rates have plummeted. Their kidnapping rates have plummeted. Their bank robberies, home invasions, you know, their indexed violent crimes, if you will, have plummeted. That's not to say that Colombia today is Shangri-La. They've still got some issues that they're dealing with. But when you also take into account the FARC is coming apart at the seams, the AUC, another designated foreign terrorist group by our country and by the European Union, has disarmed and has come to the peace table. The ELN is coming apart at the seams. Mexico can experience the same kind of success, but President Calderon and Eduardo Medina Mora and Genaro García Luna and other members of that administration understood clearly that they had to take the fight to the bad guys. And they had to nip corruption in the bud, and they had to bring these people to justice and lock them up where they belong, or they were going to lose control of the country. And that's what's going on in Mexico right now. There are a lot of brave cops, a lot of brave military personnel and security service personnel in Mexico that have paid the ultimate price to protect that country and to prevent spillover into the United States. And the same thing has happened in Colombia. I mean, some brave cops and military and security personnel in Colombia have paid the ultimate price as well. But you want to know something? We're a little bit safer in our country because of what they're doing downrange.
We have a few minutes left in this program. We have some callers. I want to get back to them, and we'll go next to someone in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Your analysis, sir, is the same analysis I've heard since I first became acquainted with pot in the 60s. Here we are 50 years later. It's the same old defeatist prohibition, gangsterism, only on a much larger scale than we had in Chicago when we had prohibition of booze. And now we've got even larger narco thugs buying weaponry with money from illicit drugs, namely Venezuela, Latin America, the Taliban. Was it mentioned that over 4,000 people have been killed in drug-related crimes this year in Mexico? This analysis about, oh, well, pot in the 60s was 6% THC, now it's 15%. That is just simply a false analysis. I have smoked.
You're absolutely right, because pot in the 60s was typically down at about a 0.5% to 1%. You're talking a guy who worked the streets undercover back in those days. I do appreciate your phone call, though. I mean, again, this is a topic that needs to be pushed out to the forefront again, and people like you and both sides need to get involved in dialogue and talk this through. That's what works in this country. It's what works in any democracy, freedom-loving country around the world. I appreciate your phone call, and I appreciate your position. I don't necessarily respect it. I certainly don't agree with it, but I appreciate you calling in and having guts enough to take a position and take a stand.
When I first smoked pot in the 60s, and I also smoke Sensimilia, which is much higher potency, it's not that much different. Yeah, you get a little more stimulation, but it's like putting an 80 horsepower motor on a speedboat as opposed to a 40 horsepower motor. You don't go twice as fast. If I were drug czar, I would take the first step, legalize pot, because people want it, people are going to buy it. Thereby, you would take billions out of the hands of the narco terrorists. That would be the biggest step.
Well, let me just ask you one question.
Yes.
And again, I don't want to cut you off, but we're running out of time. There have been a number of studies that were conducted a few years ago of commercial airline pilots that smoked marijuana, and within 24 hours, in simulators, attempted to land aircraft under very difficult and strenuous conditions. When they had smoked marijuana during the previous 24 hours, every one of them failed miserably. But when they were absolutely marijuana-free for at least a 30-day period, they had no problem in landing those aircraft. So my question is if we legalize marijuana, do we allow our pilots to get into the cockpit and fly a 747 across the country or around the world with you and me on it after they've consumed alcohol during a previous 24 or 48-hour period, knowing the results of those tests? And if we say, no, we're not going to allow them to do that, then how do we regulate that? That's one question. And then let's build on that just a little bit more. How about school bus drivers? Do I want my kid, do I want my 16-year-old son, who I put on the school bus this morning, riding on that bus after a driver has consumed marijuana over the last 24 hours or 48 hours or the last week? No, I don't.
I agree with you completely. But
well, how do we control that?
That can be tested. That, in, I believe at your hair samples, they can test for marijuana residue for as long as a few months.
Are we going to take hair samples every day and have them tested immediately? That's not the way it works.
No, if the residue lasts for months, then you could test maybe month or bi-monthly.
Okay. Well, I think most callers get my point, and I think they get yours as well. And I appreciate your phone call.
Yeah. We're at the point where I think we're going to kind of have to wrap up. I think, Mr. Braun, we need to try and let you go a little bit early here. We appreciate the fact that you've given us the time, and certainly here, obviously, we've opened the door to a discussion that would be a good discussion we have, where there are very strong positions on both sides on how it is as society we deal with drugs. But setting that aside, anything else that you might want to say about the particular issue that we started out with, and that is, you know, the issue of illegal drugs coming from Mexico and what it is that the United States is trying to do perhaps to help help the Mexicans deal with the problem that they have on their side?
Well, I mean, you know, listen, just a couple of things in closing. My heart goes out to our Mexican my Mexican colleagues and counterparts, and everyone in Mexico. But I'm telling you what, I'm convinced in my mind, based on 33 years of you know, experience in this field, that President Calderon and his administration are doing the right thing. If they do not take on the cartels will end up running that country. And I'm not saying it's a narco state or anywhere close to it now, but they obviously had access to intelligence that I don't have access to. They made the decision that the time was right to take this on right now. There are a lot of heroic cops and military and other security forces in Colombia, or excuse me, in Mexico, that have paid the ultimate price. Their families will be, you know, suffering from that for years to come. And I just, you know, hope that the American public, I would hope that the American public understands that that all cops, all public service personnel in Mexico are not corrupt. The vast majority of them aren't. Some do succumb to corruption, but that's not what it's all about. They're taking a fight to the bad guys, and they know that they've got to do it, and they're doing it. And we need to support them in every way possible. I'm one guy that doesn't think the Emerita or the Merida Initiative, quite honestly, is providing the level of funding to our Mexican counterparts that they need to get that country where it should be. When you compare the Merida funding to Plan Colombia, it just doesn't come close. Look at how effective Plan Colombia has been in Colombia. I cited the statistics earlier. It's been a glowing success. So I would end there.
All right. Well, Mr. Braun, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Thank you, David. I appreciate it.
Our guest, Michael Braun, just recently retired as chief of operations at the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Administration. He's had a long career in law enforcement. He joined the DEA in 1985. Before that, he served in the Illinois State Police in narcotics enforcement. And before that, started out his career in law enforcement in the police department of Cape Girardeau, Missouri.